the council line to order. Yay! And as my last act of today, hopefully, well, at least for this afternoon, I'm going to introduce our esteemed and wonderful second vice president of the California Council of the Blind to preside this afternoon, Donna Pomerantz.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Muchísimas gracias. Si yo hablo español. Okay, I said thank you very much. Yes, I do speak Spanish. In the interest of translation here. All right. Why don't we go ahead and start our session today with the invocation and to introduce the person who will be giving our invocation. I will have Linda Perel do introductions, please.
Thank you, Donna. First of all, I'd like to thank my fellow president, Dr. Martin Jones, because you're the one who made this presentation possible by asking the Lighthouse if they could provide some transportation for some folks to get to the convention today who otherwise might not have come. So thank you very much for that. And now I have the distinct privilege of presenting one of our own who will give the invocation today. Gilda Chico is a Buddhist teacher of meditation and the Dharma. Gilda has been involved with Shambhala International since 1981. She is a follower of the revered Buddhist Tibetan Buddhist master Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who lived for many years. I know his work. He lived for many years in the West and established ashrams here. I think the main one now is right in Nova Scotia, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So Gilda teaches classes at the Buddhist Center in San Francisco, which she says they just recently acquired a building that's fully accessible, and she really looks forward to having more diverse folks come to the Buddhist Center, and I hope to be one of them. So here is Gilda Chico.
Thank you very much. I was asked to give this invocation, and I thought, well, let's make it very ecumenical, because when I go to the meetings at California Council of the Blind, Golden Gate Chapter in San Francisco, I always open with the Our Father, and I was hoping maybe I could do that first, and maybe you could sing along this little beautiful prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is. This day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever. Amen. Okay, I'd like to say just a very few words of a Buddhist invocation. I'm trying not to use any Buddhist words. Dear Lord, please bless our body, our speech, and our mind. Please bless our mind, which allows us to think, to be aware, to reason, to know the difference between good and evil. Please bless our speech, which allows us to communicate. Please bless our bodies, which allow us to do actions in the world. Dear Lord, in this moment, I'd like to thank you for, oh, so many blessings. The blessings of the trees and the birds that sing beautiful songs for us. The blessings of the animals who are our friends and who also become our food. Poor animals. That's a little Buddhist line there. But anyway, the animals. And also thank you for the earth, which provides us ability to plant seeds and to grow food to feed us. Please, Lord, thank you for our senses, including our sight, which most of us have lost. But in this way, we have learned to know the world in a different way and maybe be a little more sensitive and a little more open, because we no longer judge people by what they look like, but what they present themselves as. So, also very special blessing for our guide dogs that guide our blind people and in mobility and become their great companions. That's wonderful. Thank you, Lord, for our senses, our touch, which is, helps us to feel very nice things like silk and satin and a nice warm blanket, and also allows us to do Braille and communicate, have a way of communicating language with the blind. Also, thank you, Lord, for our sense of smell, those beautiful scents of perfumes and perfumed food, aromas from food, and those special smells that remind us of home. Thank you, Lord, for our families, our mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, all our families and our friends. Thank you, Lord, for allowing us to have a way to express friendship, love, and compassion. Thank you, Lord, for giving us the opportunity to dedicate ourselves to the benefit of all beings. I'd like to end this with a special thought, especially with that last thought I left you with, for a moment's silence for Bill Barker, who is a major, major person in the blind community in the Bay Area. He's sick in the hospital right now, and I thought we could have a moment of silence for him. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Next, I would like to ask that Mike Keithley please come up.
I am here.
For the Pledge of Allegiance, Mike Keithley is president of the Silicon Valley Council of the Blind Chapter. Mike?
Okay, let's all rise for the pledge. I pledge my allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Mike. I'd like to see if anyone has any announcements, and I already have one person here directly to my left who said they'd like to make an announcement, and if anyone else has any announcements, please let me know.
Thank you, Donna. This is Brian Higgins, and I work at VA Palo Alto, and I'm in the Silicon Valley Council of the Blind. And this is going out in the form of an invitation, and I'd like to invite everyone to participate that's willing. I put on white cane walks from here to the East Coast. And this year I decided to do something a little bit different and put us on the map. So what I did is I applied to Guinness World Records, and we're going to set a world record of the largest amount of people at a white cane walk. We're doing this October 15th, which is White Cane Awareness Day, in Palo Alto, California. So anyone that would like to, I know that there's already people planning buses. Somebody in Sacramento has already rented a van to come down. And so I'm starting getting out in contact with all the organizations in at least Northern California, maybe Central California. And anyone that is interested in attending this event, if there's groups like schools that want to apply for a Guinness World Record certificate, a variety of these things that you can get. So I invite everyone to participate, and if you need to get in contact with me, you can get in contact with me at VA Palo Alto Blind Center, Weston Blind Rehab Center, or is all right, give out my email and phone number? Yeah. Okay, my phone number is 650-906-9412, and my email is seeingeye@comcast.net. That's S-E-E-N as in Nancy, E-Y-E, at comcast.net. Brian Higgins. I'm one of the six Brians here at the convention. Aye. But I'm Brian number one, okay.
No, she's actually not the one I printed up from the web.
Let me do my email.
One more time.
Okay, C&I, S is in Sam, E-E, N is in Nancy, E-Y-E, as in your eye, at comcast.net. Thank you.
All righty. The next part of the program is called Last Minute Edition. We have a man that we all know, Rob Turner, to give the report of the nominating committee.
Oh, thank you, Donna. Thank you. So we'll give the positions up for election first, and then we'll give the slate. So the presidential office, that's the fourth term, and so that's one. First vice president, that's his first term, that's going to be up. The treasurer position, the four directors that are up. We've got Vince Calderon, his first term, David Jackson, second term. Lena Bandy was elected last night as a partial term. And then Ken Metz isn't going to run. He's decided not to run. So those are the positions. And the slate that recommended by the nominations committee for the office of president, Donna Pomerantz, for the first vice president, the incumbent, Jean Lozano, the treasurer, the incumbent, Chris Gray, for Vince Calderon's position, the incumbent, Vince, same with David Jackson. Lena Bandy also, and for the final position, Dave Hanlon. So that's it. It was a great committee. We had a lot of fun, amazingly enough, and I want to thank everybody for their cooperation.
Thank you, Rob. Okay, our next program item is one that is definitely dear to me. Understanding your rights to alternate format from the Social Security Administration, and our presenter is Larissa Cummings, Esquire, staff attorney, Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, Berkeley, California. Larissa Cummings, okay, here. Hold on. Larissa. Thank you, Bernice. Okay. Larissa began her legal career at Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund Incorporated in 1987. Ms. Cummings earned her BA in Urban Studies in 1982 from the University of Michigan. In 1987, she earned a law degree from the University of California Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. From 1988 to 1998, she held a position as client rights advocate for persons with developmental disabilities at the Regional Center of the East Bay, a resource agency that serves over, let me see these numbers, 10,000 persons with developmental disabilities in the Oakland area. Ms. Cummings has regularly conducted educational seminars on legal topics pertaining to persons with disabilities to offer guidance about the complex interrelationships of civil rights and public benefits, entitlement law, as well as the legal parameters of capacity to make one's own decisions. Ms. Cummings' seminars have also addressed the substitute decision-making alternatives, including limited conservatorships. Can't read this letter here. And special needs trusts. Repositioning my mic here. For persons with disabilities. In 2000, Ms. Cummings returned to a staff attorney position at DREDF, where she now focuses on impact litigation to protect and further the civil rights of persons with disabilities. Ms. Larissa Cummings, thank you.
Thank you for the introduction. Thank you for the introduction. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. I've already had a chance to meet with about 10 or 12 of you with the help of Bernice, and I would hope that I get a chance to meet with most of the rest of you after my brief talk. We'll have a table in the exhibit room, and a colleague will be with me. The reason we want very much to connect with you directly is that our organization, that's DREDF for short, Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, is monitoring the judgment that we won in federal court last October. That case involved requesting alternate formats from the Social Security Administration on behalf of blind and visually impaired class members. The case took 4 years to litigate. It was fought hard. The Social Security Administration was very belligerent and refused to negotiate with us, so ultimately we landed in a trial. A couple of people here testified and did a great job in doing so. I'd like to acknowledge them, Bernice and Sam Doherty, both who are here in this room. I think partly due to their great testimony, we got a favorable judgment, and the court requires Social Security to offer and provide alternate formats to two classes of individuals, and I'll just read who those classes are. They are, number one, Social Security Administration applicants, beneficiaries, and recipients who are blind or visually impaired, and number two, representative payees for individuals who get Social Security benefits, and that is representative payees who are blind or visually impaired. The judge ordered SSA to automatically offer and provide Braille and data CD in addition to the alternatives it currently provides to these two classes of beneficiaries or recipients. Since the judgment, we continue to exert pressure on Social Security to expand options, and very recently, just about 6 weeks ago, it notified us that it has agreed to include large print and audio CD as options that it will now automatically offer and provide for notices and enclosures that go along with notices to the classes that I've listed. So what you need to know beyond that is that it's time to make a request for the format of your choice. There are about 120 people in this room, I would guess. I'd like you to raise your hand, first of all, if you heard about the judgment in the case. Looks to me like about 80% of you have. That's good. I'm glad, because we've been working hard to get the word out. I'd like to see a show of hands of people who have made a request to Social Security. And it looks to be maybe about half of the people in the room. There are several ways to make a request, and I do have information that will be available at our table in the exhibit room. It is provided in large print. If you give me your name and contact info, we will provide this summary information in the format of your choice, and we will also keep you informed of the progress of SSA's implementation of this judgment. So please, please stop by our exhibit table so that we can get your contact information and give you a summary of this great outcome that we got from the federal district court and the further great outcome that we got pressuring Social Security to expand options. The options I've listed that are automatically provided, again, are Braille, data CD, audio CD, and large print for notices that you get from Social Security and enclosures that are sent along with those notices. SSA is not prepared to provide those immediately. There is a phase-in period. It should be basically this year and the beginning of next that you will find or should find that the request you made is fully honored. The last thing I want to say is that there is still an opportunity to make a request for a different format if none of those formats work for you. And that is explained in the summary information that we'll have available. There are people who may not be satisfied with those options, and I want to make sure you know that you have a right to request the format of your choice. Beyond that, I guess the last thing I want to say is that if you didn't know before, there were already a couple of options in place. That is a telephone call or certified mail. People reported to us almost uniformly that if they made those selections, they were not honored routinely, and that is one of the reasons we brought the lawsuit. But if you have a preference for a telephone call from Social Security to read a notice to you, you certainly can still make that, and the same for certified mail. Those options are still available. They're not being eliminated, and you can change your mind and make a different format request at any time. Are there any questions or comments about what I've said? Yes, in the back.
two questions. This is Lisa Gordon. One, when I made my request for Braille, they said it was supposed to be honored as of April 15th. Is that real?
Yeah, that is the date that the judge ordered, and most recently they asked for an extension. It's a small extension. You should get Braille notices by the end of May, except for locally generated notices. They need a little more time to get all the local field offices up to speed on notices, so they have gotten an extension to September 30th. That's why I said these are going to be phased in over a period of time. And when they told us their troubles, we got them to agree to at least send a cover letter along with any standard print notice in the format request that you made. So the cover letter should come in Braille until they are able to fully implement your request for Braille.
Okay, and second part, is there any way that I can stop the print from coming and just get the Braille?
No.
Because the print, that's just something that has to be taken care of by someone other than me who can see.
You can certainly request that. What they automatically do is send the standard print along with the alternate format.
Okay.
That will be the default. Any other questions or comments up front? Oh, he's got the mic over on the other side. Just a second.
I called your office. I'm Kathy Skivers, and I called your office. I tried to get the... I called in the Social Security, the 772-1213 number, and I put with a thing you have to go through to try to get through the menu to get to a human being. You have to have a lot of, persevere very hard there. But anyhow, I got somebody, and she was very nice. She said she'd heard about it, but she didn't know how to do it because I was the first person to ever ask for it. And she said she was going to try to find it, and she had me hold about numerous times, which I was willing to do because, after all, she was doing the work of looking. Anyway, she did come back, and she said that she thought she had done it right. She'd put in my request for Braille, and if I didn't hear in a reasonable time, to call back. Well, this last week, I got a letter from Social Security saying that they have understood that I have a request for special format. It didn't say Braille, but we'll wait. It'll probably be what it says I want. But anyway, they said that there would be a delay. It should be starting at April 15th, but there might be a delay while they get everything into place. But if I had any difficulty, I could call them back at their number, but I could look forward to having my things in my format. And I thought that was very good. And I appreciate you people more than you know.
That's a great story. I want to just say that you've reminded me of a big point I wanted to make I haven't made yet, or if I have, I forgot that I made it. And that is that we are monitoring what they're doing. So that's another reason we want to get your contact information. If you would please come to the exhibit room, to our table. We want to know your experience requesting alternate format. And if you have any problems, we want to be able to take that back to the attorneys representing the Social Security Administration. We initially did hear of a lot of confusion coming from the SSA reps. We're starting to hear better news. And it sounds like even though you had to wait on hold, which is a problem we won't ever be able to fix, you were able to get it done. So when you make your request, folks, please try to make a note of the date you made that request. Try to make a note of the SSA rep you spoke to. You can also do this at the field office level and request confirmation from them that they got your request so that you can have proof in case there are problems down the road with you not getting the format you requested.
And Jeff has a question.
Yeah, Larissa, as one who did Social Security hearings like 31 years ago or so, what, let's say, you know, this thing is fully implemented and you have proof and you get a notice of an overpayment, but they forget to do the Braille or your format. Is that going to be grounds for you to get a delay or whatever, and they're going to have to comply with that before it becomes active? What is that going to mean if they don't give you the format?
Those kinds of problems, we very much want to hear about that, would be grounds for what's called a good cause waiver, so that you should not be bound to the overpayment because you did not get the notice you were supposed to get in the format you requested. And so it's really incumbent on everyone who hasn't yet made a request, who does receive Social Security benefits or is a representative payee for someone who does, to go ahead and log that request so that if there are problems with notices like overpayment notices, you can deal with them directly. And if you don't get the format you requested, you will have grounds to challenge that overpayment notice.
Okay.
I have a question. This is Preston Moses from the Alameda chapter of CCB. My question is, I was referred to the resource center in, you know, Contra Costa County, the Independent Resource Center, because I had a problem. They were talking about, you know, back in January of, you know, cutting me off if I didn't send in certain information. About, you know, and so the form they sent me was asking some questions about things like what are your hobbies, what do you like to do, you know, stuff like that that seemed rather, well, not important as far as wanting to know what your Social Security situation was. Mm-hmm. I guess my question really is do they have a right to do that? And then also, does DREDF help people in other counties other than Berkeley?
DREDF is a nationwide organization, although we're a small staff of about 15, and we have only one office in Berkeley. But we have an 800 number. It's listed in the summary information that I have here. Anybody can contact us from anywhere about this particular issue. It was a nationwide class that got certified. As for some of the things that SSA does that go beyond alternate format, we don't actually focus or handle those problems, although I will say we are currently in a case investigation mode about suing them again for further violations of what's called Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, that is refusing to accommodate people who need help responding to their questions, filling out their forms, and gathering information that they require. So we are looking at that problem. As for asking about your hobbies, I'm not sure I'll ever be able to fix that. But you certainly are entitled to help get to answer any question they ask from them. Over here is another hand in the corner.
Larissa?
Yes.
Hi, I have a question. You said that when you're... This is Steve from the San Joaquin Valley chapter. Basically, I'm asking... There we go. Okay. You said ask for a confirmation number whenever you're getting ready to get off the phone with the operator. Does that come in the form of a number and a letter, or is that, I mean, is a seven-digit long number? How does that work? And can you have them make notes in the computer
to
ensure that what you have said you want is in the system?
You can certainly ask them to make notes. I personally have always had a hard time with that when I've ever asked anybody to make notes of a conversation. You can ask for confirmation by email. You can ask for confirmation by letter. You can ask for confirmation in large print. Whatever works best for you. They are not geared up to provide you with confirmation in your format request, however.
One more question.
I see quite a few. I can take, you know, three or four more questions. There's one right next to you, Ed.
Regarding this confirmation number.
It's confirmation note or
note.
Letter. Or.
I see. So this is not a number like what you get with customer service people. They give you a confirmation, like a case number. Is it the same thing or something?
No, I mean, essentially, there are a few different ways to go about doing this, but the easiest thing, I think, to keep in mind is to call the regular 800 number, make the request. hopefully the person will know what you're talking about. If they don't, make a note of it, ask to speak to someone else. Let us know, because we're monitoring that. And then also ask for a confirmation in writing, in some format, of that they got the request that you made.
Okay, we're going to take two more questions, and any other questions after that, please go and visit Larissa in the exhibit hall. Okay, question?
Yes, this is Keith Johnson. I was receiving Social Security benefits up until January this year. I supposedly got a notice telling me that I have an overpayment and they're cutting my Social Security for a couple of years. I never got that notice. And when I called them to find out what happened to my February check, this is what they told me. So I requested them to send me all my notices in Braille. And previously to that, I had read about this in the Braille forum, so I immediately made the request over there that that number they gave with they gave with that menu. And but I just received a letter from them about last week or so, telling me that they will send me my requested format whenever possible. But that's when they said if it's available.
Yes.
Now that tells me that they're not going to certainly send me every notice in Braille, but whenever there is availability of the Braille material.
Braille is one of them, one of the options that the judge dictated timeframes for, and Social Security got a short extension for. So Braille, as compared to large print, we are more confident that they will actually deliver by the end of next month for most notices and by the end of September for locally or field office generated notices. So if you experience problems with that, we definitely would like to hear. Large print and audio CD, on the other hand, because they only recently decided to go ahead and provide those under pressure from us, those were not ordered by the judge. We have not gotten clear time frames yet as to when those will be made available, but now is certainly the time to make the request, log that request, request confirmation that you logged your request, and then hopefully in a reasonable period of time, we will have firmer time frames and better ways to monitor the delivery of those options.
Okay, thank you very much. And if anyone else wants to ask any questions, please, please go and visit Larissa in the exhibit hall.
Yeah, the venue has been changed.
Yeah.
We did, that was the original plan anyway, and I didn't realize it was firmed up, and
yes.
So it was. So they're going to be, there are more people in exhibit rooms in the exhibit room than there are at registration. And when if exhibit room does tend to empty out, they can always be outside this room. If there are people there, they can catch them there. So really, they can float around and see where they can get people. I don't think it's a problem.
Absolutely.
Well,
sorry, we're behind schedule. I just want to thank you for coming. And again, please go visit Larissa in the exhibit
hall.
Thank
you.
Thank you. Next, we have Department of Rehabilitation in Budgetary Hard Times. We have with us Luciana Profazza, Chief Deputy Director. We have Joe Xavier, who is the Acting Deputy Director, Specialized Services Division, Department of Rehabilitation in Sacramento. And we also have Catherine Bales, Blindfield Services District Administrator, again, Department of Rehabilitation in Sacramento. Welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And first, let me say, Donna, thank you for pronouncing my name so beautifully. I've not heard it done so nicely, and I really appreciate that. Luciana Profazza.
We can thank Ed Branch for that.
Thank you. Okay. And let me first begin by acknowledging the beautiful invocation that was done by Ms. Chico. And I want to acknowledge that with her today is her 93-year-old mother. And you, and she doesn't look a day over 60, I must say. So it's wonderful to see you here. And also to acknowledge Brian Bashan, and congratulations, Brian, on your new appointment at the wonderful Lighthouse. Very proud of you. With me today, as you heard, are Joe Xavier and Catherine Bales, but there are many other present and former staff of the Department of Rehabilitation, and if I could just identify some of them. Deb Meyer, who is our staff services manager for the Business Enterprise Program, is here. Linda Woodbury, our new program manager for the Orientation Center for the Blind. Joe Smith, who had been a long employee who's come back to us as a retired annuitant, and he's with our Older Individuals Who Are Blind program. Trisha Leitz, who I'm so happy to say is a rehabilitation supervisor, and it took some bending of the arm and encouragement and encouragement and encouragement to have her do that. And absolutely one of the finest counselors in the state of California, and we're so happy that she moved forward to be a supervisor with us. We have the Crespins here, and Ed and Christy, and they're so grateful for the service that they've provided to the department through the years. Rehabilitation supervisor Jerry Arakawa is here with us from Southern California. Have I missed anyone? Oh, Richard. There's Richard with the School for the Blind. But Richard used to be with the School for the Blind, but he's long gone to the Lighthouse. Anybody else here that I've missed from the department? Okay, good. Well, we're so grateful for the services of all of our great staff. Our director, Tony Sauer, would have wanted to be here today, and he asked me to please send his warm regards for a wonderful convention. He is a brilliant and dedicated and committed leader to the department and is extremely committed to services for people who are blind and visually impaired. So I feel very grateful to have the opportunity to work with him. You know, my job today is to provide a very quick overview so that Joe and Kathy can give you more of the details. But some of the issues that I wanted to talk about a little bit, and the title is The Department of Rehabilitation in Budgetary Hard Times. These are probably among some of the most challenging times in state governments. Those of you who have friends and neighbors, and maybe even among you who have lost their homes, the foreclosure signs are all over the place. This is the largest percentage of unemployment in the state of California's history at 12.6%. These are hard times. But despite that fact, the department keeps moving forward. We keep providing services. In this budget year, we're currently in the middle of legislative hearings. And even though there is a $20 billion general fund deficit in the state of California, we, the Department of Rehabilitation, have not lost any state or federal funds. We're really pleased about that. The fact that our program is 80% federal funded has been a tremendous benefit for us throughout the years, and we've continued to fare very, very well. As you know from the governor's budget, The proposal is for a 5% decrease in staffing for the department, a 5% decrease in counselor salaries, not only counselors, but all staff of the department, our almost 2,000 staff, a 5% increase of staff contributions to their retirement benefits. Mm-hmm. So if the governor's budget is approved in July or August or September or October, we know from the past that, and we are really anticipating another very challenging year in getting the budget approved. We're looking at tremendous challenges for our staff and continuing to provide services with a smaller staff. But I just want you to hear our commitment to do the very best job we can for all of our consumers and for our consumers who are blind and visually impaired. You also know that currently our staff are on furloughs 3 days a week. We call them furlough Fridays. That's about a 15% reduction in their salaries.
Three
but in
days a month.
3 days a month. Does it feel like 3 days a week sometimes? 3 days a month. Thank you, Dan, for that clarification. First three Fridays, but those furlough Fridays are due to end on June 30th, so we're looking forward to our staff coming back to work full time. Also, I wanted you to hear about just some of the highlights. One is we are in the middle of a VR, vocational rehabilitation modernization project to improve our operations and our services to consumers. Also, to be in compliance with our Federal Control Agency Rehabilitation Services Administration. So we're really excited about that. The VR Mod project has two overarching goals. One, to ensure compliance with federal and state regulatory requirements, but even more importantly, to streamline and simplify the delivery of vocational rehabilitation services that will most effectively and efficiently serve our consumers. Included in that VR Mod project is a new computer network system that the goal of that system, and it should be fully operational by about the middle of next year. This has been a project that's been about 8 years in the making, so we are really looking forward to that. And from the day that our director came into office, what he said he wanted was that more FaceTime could be spent with our counselors and our consumers rather than spending time behind the computer and doing other paperwork. So this new, it's called ERS, Electronic Records System, should significantly streamline our processes. So we're really looking forward to that. Kathy and Joe will talk a little bit more about Blind Field Services, but we are just so proud of some of our accomplishments there, very good outcomes. We are really excited about filling the Deputy Director of Specialized Services position. It is an extremely important position for the Department of Rehabilitation. Joe has accepted the position on a temporary basis until the position is filled permanently, and as you know, he is currently the deputy director of our Independent Living and External Affairs Division, had been an acting program manager for the Business Enterprises Program, had participated on the CVPC, many leadership roles within the department, so we're very grateful for him to have stepped up in this way. Also, I wanted you to hear a little bit about ERA. When I say ERA, do you know what I'm talking about? The American Reinvestment and Recovery Act? The stimulus. Thank you. That's another name for the stimulus package. And the Department of Rehabilitation was awarded $61.8 million, a significant number of dollars. Amazing. When you think that our entire budget is $400 million a year, that we receive $61 million in stimulus dollars, which must be expended no later than December 2011. So it was a two-year project. $56 million for vocational rehabilitation, $1.6 million for independent living, and $3.7 million for the Older Individuals Who Are Blind program. We're really excited about some of those projects. And the way the projects were determined, we had four public hearings across the state, received stakeholder input from about 400 individuals, which really helped guide how those dollars would be expended. There were a total of 38 projects identified, and I can say that as of today, or actually the end of January, we expended about 30% of those dollars, hired 141 new individuals, received jobs. Many of those were students. Some of those were retired annuitants. A lot of internship dollars, a lot of dollars into on-the-job training projects. $20 million were identified specifically to private, nonprofit, and public agencies, and they included such areas as 30 programs in community rehabilitation programs, 150 cooperative partner agencies, 13 projects totaling about $3.2 million in the Older Individuals Who Are Blind program. They were awarded to a list of amazing, wonderful organizations. Kathy, are you going to list those, or shall I? Kathy's going to list. Okay. Do you want me to list the organizations, or you're going to do that? Shall I?
I'll go ahead.
Okay. They are the Earl Baum Center, received $210,000. Independent Services of Northern California and Chico, $100,000. Lions Center for the Blind in Oakland, $180,000. Lions Center for the Blind in Diablo Valley, $500,000. Wow. The Vista Center in Palo Alto, $180,000. Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco, $404,000. Society for the Blind in Sacramento, $499,000. Blindness Support Services in Riverside, $100,000. Center for the Partially Sighted in Los Angeles, $500,000. Community Access in Riverside, $141,000. Dale McIntosh Center in Garden Grove, $180,000. San Diego Center for the Blind, $100,000. And VTC Enterprises in Santa Maria, $180,000. So needless to say, we are so excited that these dollars have become available and that they will significantly benefit older individuals who are blind. We were also really pleased to be able to take our wonderful orientation center. Many of you in the room have participated in services from OCB in Albany. And you also know that that center was built in 1963 with not many renovations and changes since that time. And with the ERA dollars, we were able to identify $7 million to improve the training facilities, to refurbish the dorms, to create some independent living studio apartments within OCB, to do some ADA and seismic upgrades, to develop a conferencing center. So we're extremely thrilled and proud of some of those changes. We expect all of those renovations to be completed in 2010. So it's a relatively short turnaround. We've also invested $2.1 million in on-the-job training contracts for our consumers. Many of those individuals are people who are blind or visually impaired. 22 small business ventures through those ERA dollars. We are providing some training opportunities for our own staff to get their master's degrees in rehabilitation counseling so that they can be identified as qualified rehabilitation professionals. As you know, there's this increase in individuals who are being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders, so investing some resources and providing some training to our staff in that area. The Business Enterprises Program identified seven new sites for our BEP program and are very pleased about that. And then finally, just to give you some basic statistical data, as you know, we have somewhere between 750 and 770 counselors at any given time, 85 offices throughout the state of California where we serve individuals, 13 districts, and Blind Field Services, which is its own distinct district. We touch about 115,000 consumers in any given year. About 9% of those individuals are blind or visually impaired. We have an average caseload at any given time of about 76,000. And the return on investment, this is important. Whenever you're out there talking to legislators, for every dollar that the department spends, $8 goes back into tax rolls. People go to work and actually are there investing in their communities and are paying taxes. So we're extremely proud of the work that we do, are very grateful for the partnerships that we have with each of you who are our stakeholders and our community partners. And with that, let me pass it on to Joe Xavier, who is our Acting Deputy Director, Specialized Services. And again, thank you for letting me be with you today.
Well, let me also add my congratulations and good wishes for another successful convention for the California Council of the Blind. When I was asked to come and present here, I thought, this is really interesting. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, it was suggested to me that if I really wanted to make a difference, to channel my energy into working with the organized blind and not just one group, but with the organized blind in California. And so I was asked to come to the California Council of the Blind and become involved and become a participant. So since 1990, I have spent a lot of time sitting back there in the fourth row from the back, usually over towards the left side, listening to presentations, listening to speakers, hearing the questions, going to the different seminars, visiting the exhibits. And during that entire time, I must tell you that I did not think I'd be the one sitting up here providing an update. So here I am. So those of you who are sitting in the fourth row from the back over on the left-hand side, be careful. You know, really, one of the things that I want to make sure that I share with you as a former consumer of the Department of Rehabilitation, as someone who was touched by what the department did, I also think it's very important that I share what the California Council of the Blind has done for me and for many others, as have all the other organizations who work to advance the opportunity for individuals who have disabilities. Many times when you're out there and you're a person with a disability, you don't realize that the work that occurs in these conventions and in the work that was just spoken to earlier, working with Social Security, how that has an incremental but forever progressive impact on how we have independence and opportunity for employment in our lives. So I want to acknowledge the council for all the many, many little steps that lead to huge progress and huge outcomes. Although, let me also be the one to say, I don't think we are where we want to be. But we are making progress. It seems painfully slow. It is moving forward, and we'll keep it moving forward, I am sure. But thank you to the council for what you do. Thank you for what you have done for me as an individual with a disability and many other people who don't come here and who don't necessarily know the work that you're doing but benefit from it. I also want to speak to a couple of issues. The council during the last session passed a number of resolutions that have to do with the programs under the Specialized Services Division. So I want to have already discussed this with Jeff and with Frank, and the resolutions have been made available to me, and we will be preparing and responding to those resolutions in the coming weeks. I wanted to share that with you. And then also acknowledge and speak very high level to the survey that was done by the consortium on the services that have been provided and received under the Blind Field Services. I believe that the survey points out areas where we have opportunity for improvement, and I want to share with you that as the department looks at that survey, we take it seriously. We recognize that there are opportunities there where we can improve, and one of the things that I will be working on, as long as I keep my acting hat on and continue to do this, is enhancing the partnerships with each of the organizations, with each of the individuals, with our service providers, and with our staff and our different programs to continue to advance the opportunity for the independents and for the employment of persons with disabilities. It is something that is easier to say than it is to do, but it must be done. And know that that's a commitment that I bring to this and will be working on over the coming days and weeks. I also want to take a moment and put a plug in for the census. I know there's not enough media out there on that yet. But let me approach it from a little bit different angle. We do not get enough money in California. And in order for us to get more money in California, we need every single eligible Californian that can be counted to be counted. Yeah. So please, if you have not, or you know someone that has not, because it's not a big deal, what's one person? It's money. There are some $300 billion that get distributed based on the population. A number of our grants, all the money that Luciana alluded to, was distributed to California based on our population. Anything that we can do to increase the number of Californians translates to an increased flow of dollars to California for all the programs that are near and dear to us and for all of the other programs that we benefit from directly and indirectly. So there's my plug. If you haven't done it, get it done. Fill it out. There's actually, I've actually got a note that there's actually a phone that you can actually, a phone number you can call and do the census by phone. So there's no excuses. Okay. Let me give you a couple of updates on some of the programs, and then Kathy will speak a little bit to blind field services and to the older individuals who are blind. In the Business Enterprises Program, there's a number of new BEP staff that have come on board. Deb is in the back. She's been with us for less than 2 years. She's finally been able to fill her assistant program manager with Asochi Pederas, who came on board, I think, in December of this past year. And there are a number of other new BEP staff that have joined the program over the last number of months, which is a good thing for the program, and which I think will be very beneficial as Deb works to move the program and move policy in the program forward. Luciana alluded to the stimulus funds and to the money that was provided for BEP sites. Boron and Camp Roberts are nearing completion and will be coming online hopefully soon. And LAX is another location that will be funded by stimulus dollars that will is moving forward and will provide another opportunity for a BEP vendor. This, at the end of March, one of my first duties in my acting capacity was to speak to the BEP training class, and they were graduating. So we graduated six new vendors who are now out there applying for locations and beginning their employment opportunity, which will lead them to further independence. We are also working, spending an awful lot of resources, BEP staff and other staff from the department, on the Marine Corps contract. And that entails a collaboration of Arizona, California, the Marines, a teaming partner, six vendors from California, and one vendor yet to be identified from Arizona. Now, try coordinating all that if you have nothing else to do. It's a very worthwhile effort. It is very complicated. It has undergone a number of extensions. The most recent one has a proposal submittal due on May 14th. And so we'll continue to work with all of these parties to submit a qualified, responsive, and responsible proposal to the Marines. And God willing, we'll prevail, and we'll have an opportunity for six very nice locations for six vendors here in California. On the OCB, first of all, again, welcome to Linda Woodbury. She's taken the leadership, assumed the leadership of OCB, and she was earlier presented to the OCB alumni. And I'm sure you join me in congratulating her and welcoming her aboard. And she has her hands full. There are many many things for Linda to work on. She and I have spent a lot of time on the phone processing, talking, investigating, and strategizing, and so a lot to do there. But one thing that I wanted to speak to a little bit more, and Luciana again alluded to the stimulus money that's being done there and some of what the project entails. One thing that we will be very, very sure to address is both the safety of our staff who work there, as well as the consumer who is there. So know that while all this is taking place, it is a very high priority for all of us, and know that we are working on this. And Linda, this is not a project that just involves Linda. We have Warren Hayes, who is a retired annuitant who's been with the state a very long time, who is a very organized, very well-developed individual in terms of his managerial and his leadership skills to advance a project of this magnitude. And he is supported by a team from within DOR, which includes our business services, who has a significant amount in working with renovations. One of the most recent ones was our headquarters office in Sacramento. And then also our procurement staff, our budget staff. So there's a whole team behind Linda in making sure that what's occurring at OCB is done on time, on budget, and in as safe as we can possibly do that. At this time, I'm going to turn this over to Kathy to give you some updates on the blind field services side and the OIB side, and then if we don't get the hook, we'll be glad to answer a question or two.
Thank you, Joe. And I put a plug in right here that I'm not sure who gets to make the final decision as to who our new deputy director is, but I sure would love it to be Joe if he would just shift his hat. So it's been a pleasure these past few weeks working with Joe and getting to know him better. And I think we're in very good hands. So if anybody's concerned, we are in very good hands with Joe Xavier. So thank you, Joe, for all your leadership. And Luciana, too. I want to thank everybody for having us come to speak today. And it's always a pleasure to be at the CCB convention. I was at the one for your 75th in Fresno. In fact, we brought our management team there. And it was really a great experience for all of them because most of them had never attended a convention before. So I was really pleased that they were able to do so. Let me move this mic over a little bit. I just wanted to, before I acknowledge some of the folks that are here from Department of Rehab, and I know Luciana did, but I want to say a couple words about the folks that are here too. We lost one of our counselors a week ago, and many of you knew Barbara Koslava Messenger. And this was a big loss to her family, to the blind community, and most definitely to Department of Rehabilitation. She was with the department for 12 and a half years, and she served from the Richmond area and that surrounding area. I've spoken to members of her family, and they are really struggling with this loss. And so I know that all of you will share with me in giving your condolences to the family and letting them know that Barbara made a significant difference in the lives of so many people with vision loss. And so I just wanted to acknowledge Barbara here. And we're going to be having our SB 105 training this next week, and Barbara was on the committee that helped to plan and prepare for that training. So we are going to miss her. And when it comes to some of the folks here in the room, they were mentioned, but I just want to say thank you to each one of you for the work that you have done in these most difficult times. As we know, we talked about 3 furlough days a month, not a week, but a month. It just seems like it sometimes. And working with more consumers. We've increased our applications by over 5%. And we've also increased the number of plans we've been writing by 8.6%. So in spite of having fewer days to work, and in some cases fewer counselors because we've gone through some staffing changes as well, we are really working hard. And each one of our counselors are just doing a tremendous job. And it's because they care so much about the people they are serving. And their caseloads have increased in some regards because people are losing their jobs. We are living in these very difficult times. And so people may be losing their jobs, or maybe they had decided to retire, and guess what? They just can't make it anymore on that retirement, and they have to come back to work. And so they return to us as well. So our counselors are doing a great job. I can't applaud them more. I hope you all applaud them and thank them for the work they're doing. Thank you. Please do. They truly care. They're innovative. They're creative. And that's what we need. We need people that are like that. When it comes to our hourly wage for the people that do go to work with who are blind and visually impaired, the hourly wage is $19.50. That's the average. So you know there's quite a few that are much higher than that. And do you know that's $7 higher than our general consumers from the Department of Rehabilitation. So we are facilitating, helping our consumers to go to work in careers that really can sustain them. And that's really exciting. That may mean that our consumers are in plan longer because they're going to college, because they're getting those degrees or more advanced education, post-secondary education. And they require the additional training so they can have the careers that are going to sustain them in this economic time. So I'm really pleased with that. When it comes to our staff, we have made some changes, and we have new counselors that have just recently been hired. Three new counselors. One counselor is going to be in Napa. We've never had a counselor in Napa in that branch office before. And because we see the need to be in these rural areas, we decided to move a position over to Napa. That person will begin in May. And then we just brought somebody over from Dan Mays from EPS, has transferred over to Blind Field Services, and he too is going to start May 3rd, and we're excited about that. I think he's going to bring a vast experience from being on the generalist side of Department of Rehab and now coming over and sharing his experience and knowledge with Blind Field Services. I did just hire a new counselor in Sacramento. Her name is Karen Coons. And she came highly recommended to me. And I was so impressed with her during the interview. And so within a day or two, I offered her the position. And I was thrilled that she said yes. And she had been a rehab counselor, but with the Northern Sierra District 3 years ago. And then she went over to Delta Community College. So just thought that she would get some additional experience over there, but you know what? She missed Department of Rehab. And, you know, we're really a family. And she knew what we were doing, and she believed so much in our mission that she wanted to come back. She knew she had maybe jumped ship too fast. And so she came back to us, and I'm really getting to know her. She started on April 5th, and she's already got a caseload and working hard. So that's really good. We also have two interns in the downstairs, because in central office in our office on the first floor. So we have several interns throughout the state right now. And some of those interns are being paid through the ARRA, or the stimulus funds. We're going to be hiring two new counselors in the Oakland area. Richard, as we've heard, Richard jumped ship on me, but we do have to congratulate him, though, because I know what he's going to be doing at San Francisco Lighthouse is going to be, really it's going to benefit us as well, and it's going to benefit the whole community. So, I will say congratulations, Richard, but I do miss him, okay? I miss him a lot. He was our transition coordinator. And so we will be, Tricia, where are you? Okay. Tricia is going to be doing and has already started interviewing to try to fill behind Richard, not to replace Richard. That's not going to happen. But we're going to fill behind, and we hope to have a counselor aboard within another few weeks. And then also one of our counselors, Dana Mitchell, went over to EPS. See how we do? We have little musical chairs around here. And so Tricia is also in the process of hiring, going to recruit and hire for a counselor for that position. Kathleen Coombs went over to EPS. She was down in Southern California. She, too, worked very well with our transition age youth. So we're in the process of interviewing to fill behind there. I have three rehabilitation supervisor positions that I am so anxious to get filled. One is up here in Northern California, would be at the Concord office to fill behind where Linda Paravagna had been. Then another one is in Van Nuys for the Sam Goldberg has come back as a retired annuitant for that position, but I'm sure he would like to continue to be retired. I've been working him very hard. And then Mary Calloway had retired, and so Nellie Emerson went over to her position, so now I've got to fill behind Nellie in Los Angeles. We just keep moving folks around. But it is an exciting time, and I should be able to start filling those positions within the next month or so. Let me take a drink of water. Okay. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the Older Individuals Who Are Blind program, OIB, and Joe Smith. Can you stand up, Joe Smith? Where are you?
He's in the fourth row.
He's in the fourth row in the back to the left. Yeah. Okay. Right where Joe Xavier used to sit. Okay. Well, I don't know what I would have done if Joe hadn't said that he would come back as a retired annuitant. I can't thank him enough. He tells me all the time, I'm retired, and I'm looking at him in the office, and I'm going, so what are you doing here then? And then the other day he said something about that he got his paycheck. And I said, if you're retired, how did you get a paycheck? Well, let me tell you, he has helped us so much in these past couple months. He came back January 4th, I think it was. So my goodness, that's been 4 months already. And we got the annual report out. Thank you, Joe. And we found out that last year with the Older Individuals Who Are Blind program, the Title VII program, we served 5,272 people throughout the state. And that was with the help of 17 agencies throughout the state. That is an increase from last year. I think the year before, 2008, it was a little over 4,500. So we have certainly the agencies out there and the funds that we are receiving from the federal government have helped us to serve people who are blind or visually impaired, who are older citizens, so much more. And with the stimulus funds, as Luciana said, we have $3.7 million that came from the stimulus funds. And we have 13 agencies. They are expanding the services to serve those older blind. And many of those that are older blind, 55 and older, they're going to be going back to work. Some of them are saying, wow, I didn't know I could do all this. I'm going to go back to work, or I'm going to be able to keep my job. So that's great. That is just great. And we had two more stimulus programs, $60,000 each, one for San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind and one for the Center for the Partially Sighted in Los Angeles. And with those, it's going to be training programs, not only for the deafblind, but also for staff who serve people who are blind or visually impaired. So it's really, really going to be an exciting year coming up with those trainings and how we can help people to live more independently and find out that, you know what, there is indeed life after vision loss. And many of us really do know that. So we're excited about that. We had a situation where Sensory Access Foundation had to close down last month. And that was such an enormous loss for us. I can't tell you how I received a phone call from Diane Drews one morning, and she said, Kathy, we're closing our doors at the end of the month. And I just... I couldn't believe it. I was, and I'm usually not speechless, you know me. I can talk. This time she caught me so off guard. And so, but it did happen after 37 years. So we are looking to make sure that our folks who are blind or visually impaired who were served by SAF will still be receiving the services that they need from the other surrounding agencies. And some of the stimulus funds are going to be helping some of those agencies be able to provide the services that are needed in those surrounding areas. They're never going to take the place of SAF. I know that, and the staff that were there. But we are going to make every effort to make sure that our consumers are receiving the services that they do need. Well, I'm going to close because I think you guys have a full agenda going on, and I guess we can entertain some questions. What do you think, Jeff? I'll let you decide.
Okay, go ahead then.
We'll have time for two questions.
Two.
Hi, this is Stephen from the San Joaquin Valley chapter. I'd like to say, first of all, I'm a benefactor of the services the Department of Rehab offers. Thank you very much. I would, however, like to ask Luciana of the list of the ARA or ERA monies or stimulus monies that were mentioned, why did I not hear anything in the San Joaquin Valley?
I'm not Luciana, but let me try. One of the things that occurs with these, when the stimulus money was sent out and people were provided an opportunity to submit proposals. And so proposals, and the money went out in two fashions. Number one, on the VR side, where they could submit a proposal for a concept or services that they wanted to provide. And those proposals were evaluated and scored and funded within the allotment that was available. The other monies that went out in two other avenues, one was on the independent living side and one was on the OIB side that Kathy just spoke to. So on the OIB side, the same thing. Your centers had an opportunity to submit their proposals for what the projects were that they had in funding them. So I don't know if anybody from that area submitted a proposal that did not score enough or they did not submit a proposal at all.
Kathy is sharing that there were no proposals from that area.
Can I just follow up, please? I'm going to speak to my comments. The census requires, we have a real problem in the valley with...
Quickly,
thank you very much.
Please. Yeah,
okay,
quickly. Briefly.
Yeah, census is a problem in the valley. People don't reply. So is that a contributing factor to why this stimulus money isn't coming to the valley as well?
No, I don't think so at all. I don't think there's no connection. But just so you know, there's an awful lot of effort amongst state agencies, community-based organizations to reach out to what is termed the hard-to-reach and the hard-to-count population. I mean, even the Department of Public Health is reaching out through their avenue. So everybody who can reach out to encourage a complete count is doing so.
Okay, and the last question, please.
Yeah, this is Dan Kaiser, and I'm really proud of Joe Xavier because I know how he got his start. I think I'm qualified to do his job because we both used to drain deep fat fryers. So I know I can do the job. Oh, sorry, no. I wanted to. I saw the list of agencies and how much money they got, and I saw a couple of small agencies that seem to get a lot more than a lot of big agencies. And can somebody explain that disparity for me, or how that funding is based?
Yes, I can. Again, when I alluded earlier to the fact that, proposals were sent out, part of that was the individuals or the individual respondents also proposed the level of funding that they would need to accomplish the project that they were proposing. So it was really driven by the organization submitting the proposal, what they were proposing, and what was necessary to fund it.
Okay, thank you very much for coming, and thank you, everybody.
Thank you all.
Okay. The next item on our convention agenda is called Putting Together an Entertainment and Recreation Listing and Its Benefits to Your Organization. The presenter for this item is our own Beth Berenson, Vision Loss Resource Center Program Coordinator at the Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired in San Francisco. Beth's many duties at the Lighthouse include coordinating programming for the consumers and Lighthouse staff. Beth's many duties at the Lighthouse include coordinating programming for the consumers and Lighthouse staff and answering information and referral inquiries. Her favorite job assignment has been publishing, I know this one and I'm jealous too, publishing a Northern California entertainment and recreation listing. It is sent out on Fridays to over 150 email addressees, as well as to, this is how I know about it, the CCBL listserv. She is also a member of the San Francisco chapter of CCB. Beth, welcome.
Okay, I think we need to talk about fun. The last conversation was very great. It was important information, but it seems like it's getting later in the afternoon and we need some entertainment and recreation in our lives before we go to attitude adjustment. Does that sound reasonable? Okay. Okay, and I know that you've been here a while. I'm going to try to get through this a little bit earlier. Let's see how it goes. I started doing this list about 3 years ago. It'll be 3 years in March. When I was hired, one of the reasons I was hired was to do this list. When the management of the Lighthouse was coming up with the idea of the Vision Loss Resource Center, my boss came to me and said, "What do you think about putting out a listing of accessible entertainment?" And immediately I went, "When do I start?" And she said, "Well, come up, you know." Jesse Lorenz, like some of you know, is a very organized person. And she said, "You have to submit a plan." And my plan was to go on Mopix. First of all, let me ask this. How many of you, by clapping, how many of you know about my recreation listing? Either... Oh, I love it. I love it. Okay. Thank you. How many of you know about Mopix? So what I found in doing this list is that it is a huge community builder. Because the first time I came to one of the CCB meetings, people walked up to me and said, "Oh, you're the person who does that list." And these were people from Southern California who were saying this.
I'm jealous.
Well, I'm here to tell you that someone in Southern California needs to do this as well. It is not a difficult process, and the payoff is huge. This has helped me get people in the door of the lighthouse. As you notice, all the lighthouse activities are on this as well. It also helps me in working with other organizations in my area. And I think one of the reasons that we have such good relations in our area, I think the blind agencies in Northern California work together amazingly. We are all friends. There's no animosity. I publicize everyone's program because it helps all of our community. So you will see, okay, you won't see it on the listserv, but you'll see activities from other organizations as well, because it needs to be fair. So everything is listed in this. If it's in Northern California, very recently I stumbled on a website that lists every accessible movie theater, and I think the country, maybe the world. And it has recently added audio description to its accessibility features. And because of that, I have made this list totally Northern California. So if you live in Turlock, there is a movie theater in Turlock that has audio described movies. Same thing for Fresno. And I think that's pretty significant, because I live in San Francisco, and sometimes I have nothing playing. But if I went to Turlock this week, I could probably see Date Night. The other wonderful thing is, if you're traveling around the Northern California area, it tells you what's going on. So if you were in Sacramento next week, you could go see Little House on the Prairie. Okay.
Can you give me the time, then I will not pronounce it.
What time is it at?
I believe it is, I want to say it's 2 o'clock.
2:30.
And if you wanted to have dinner afterwards, you could talk with Margie. And since Margie Donovan isn't here, I'm sure you could talk with Jeff, and he could tell you all the details, because they are going out to dinner afterwards with the person who is doing the audio description. Does that cover everything you needed, Jeff?
That's great. Yes, that's great. And the Capital Chapter is helping to sponsor it.
Yay, Capital Chapter.
So this is a great, I urge people, either an agency to take this up in Southern California or a chapter in Southern California. It's been a very, very helpful thing in community building. It got me here too.
Yay.
It is very, very easy to do. I went out when I was getting ready to do this 3 years ago. I went and visited everything I could possibly think of in our area. I went to Silicon Valley CCB meetings. I went to different agencies and talked about this and made phone calls. I got to know a lot of great, great people. And eventually things started coming in from other places. I have a very good relationship right now with the Shorenstein Hayes Company. And they're really great about letting me know when there's going to be new audio described plays. I think I also need to step back for one moment and ask, is there anyone here who does not understand when I say audio described? I'm just assuming I'm talking to the choir, and maybe I'm not. Is there anyone who doesn't understand this? Okay, I am talking to the choir. Good. Good. I've also been able to do a little bit of advocacy work on behalf of audio description. There was something came to my attention that the San Francisco Library was putting on, and they were not having it. It was having it audio described, and I was able to step in and say, you can't have this particular program without it being audio described. It was... does anyone know what Superfest is?
Yes.
Okay, they were showing. Superfest is a film festival that is put on in Berkeley. It's put on every year. And what they've done, and it is all audio described. It is by and about people with disabilities. So a lot of the people who are producing the movies, or a lot of the subject matter, are people with disabilities. And the library was going to put this on, but not with the audio described track. And we were able, with some getting the mayor's office on disability in San Francisco involved, we were able to get it audio described, and about 15 people showed up for the audio description. And the reason that they said they weren't going to audio describe it was because no one ever comes. And I'm like, does anyone in our community know about it?
Exactly.
If you don't tell people, no one will come. And it's been a very good experience to be able to do this. Through this listing, we've also been able to get the news out about our Vision Loss Resource Center tech seminars. And a show of clapping, how many of you have been to one of these? Oh, that's nowheres enough people. Nowheres enough people. There should be more. One of the nice features of our tech seminars is that for the most part we broadcast them live stream. You can come in person. Usually if you can come in person, you can play with whatever technology we're talking about. And we're doing some experimentation. We have our next one is going to be Saturday, May 8th at the Lighthouse from 1 to 3. We also will have this broadcast on our website. And we ask you to sign up for that. I have in the back, I have in large print and in Braille both this week's event listing. And I'll tell you, this is the only time you're ever getting this in hard copy. Never again. This gets delivered to your email box Friday or before. Sometimes I'm lucky and can do it a little bit earlier, so you'll get a head up on Friday night, date night. But sometimes you have to wait until Friday. It just depends on how busy life is. But it's there. You can look at it. You can also look at it on our website. We tweet. We Facebook. We also put it on CCBL. Things that are of interest to the whole community, because we know not everyone is on CCBL. Lots of times you'll see functions that we want everyone to know about. We'll put them in the connection. We have a straight email to Gabe. Works out great. The easiness of doing this today, maybe it takes me an hour a day to do an hour on Friday to actually sit down and put it together. It's a cut and paste, basically cut and paste from something I've already done. I have a distribution list of probably now close to 200 people, 200 addresses that this goes out to. Throughout the weekend, I've been able to build that address, because if I don't already have your email address, I obviously need it, because your life is lacking without this list. You're staying home way too much. You need to get out. I don't know if you know about BORP or Blind Sailors. There's so many things to do in the Bay Area and beyond that it's great to be able to have one concise place to look. And I'm certainly willing to take questions, any questions that you have for me. I want to make sure, though, that before everyone leaves, I'm going to be in the back, and as you walk out the door, I am giving you paperwork. I am not bringing any paperwork back with me to the Lighthouse, because then I have not accomplished my goal. I want to definitely hear if there are people from Southern California who would like guidance on how to do this and its benefits.
Okay, I'm going to take three questions, and then we'll need to go ahead and move on, but you will definitely see Beth around.
Okay, I heard that my important question is, how do you subscribe? I will give you one of the lists, and I will have you email me. I have my business cards here. I have the lists here.
What is your website?
My website is www.lighthouse-sf.org. And I'm going to repeat it again, because those people who are listening live stream, there's no reason you can't sign up for this as well. It is www.lighthouse-sf.org. And I'm going to give you my email address, bbrenson@lighthouse-sf.org. And I'm going to do it one more time because I thank you. Okay. I'm from the East Coast. This is my speed. I will slow down. Okay. It's B-B-E-R-E-N, N as in Nancy, S.
One N. One.
When you say B. Berenson, you can spell the Berenson.
Okay, B, I'm going to start all over. Okay, here we go. And I'm going to go slow. B. Berenson at lighthouse-sf.org. And now I'm going to spell it. But I'm going to spell it with the words. So it's B as in boy, B as in boy, E as in elephant, R as in Robert, E as in elephant, N as in Nancy, S as in Sam, O as in octopus. Don't ask me to spell it, but I know it begins with an O. Octopus. N is in Nancy. Is that easier? Could people get it that way?
Yes, they didn't get it.
At lighthouse-sf.org. 415. Four, 415-694-7322. 415-694-7322. I am always looking for things to put on this list. Because if it just has lighthouse activities, people will stop reading it eventually. I hate to tell you that. Because not all of you are close enough to do all the lighthouse activities that we have.
Okay, we have our next question.
Okay.
I have a question. This is Keith Johnson. Would you ever list any beer or wine festivals in the Northern California part or any part of the state?
I certainly would if a blind organization was putting it on, or you could guarantee me that when I walk over to the vending booth, someone is going to give me something in alternative format. I will come to any part of the state to go to that wine festival.
Because there's one called the Paso Robles Wine Festival that's on May 22nd.
Is it accessible? Because this is all about...
I don't know. I just heard about this morning.
It has to be accessible.
Okay.
If you can guarantee me that there will be Braille menus everywhere and large prints,
yay,
I'll be there.
Yeah. Next question, please.
Yeah, Braille mugs, Braille wine glasses. The key to this is accessible.
Yeah.
So if it's not accessible, unfortunately, no.
Okay, I'm told we have no more questions. So, Beth, thank you very much.
Thank you. Please come see me in the back.
And don't forget to pick up her handouts that she has left in the back. They are collector's items because she said it's the one and only hard copy you'll ever get. We have Easy Steps for CCB Advocacy. Our presenter is our own Frank Welty, Director of Governmental Affairs, CCB, from San Leandro, California.
And basically, in these times of term limits and budget deficits in Sacramento, it's more important than ever that CCB members become strong advocates in our local community. This presentation will provide you with the steps you can take to influence your community leaders to make life better for people living with vision loss. Frank Welty.
Hello. I have some real good news. For the next half hour, you are not going to hear a single bill number. Is that cool or what? And it's not going to be a lecture. We're going to have a discussion. Where this came about is that I had contact from an individual who has been asking me repeatedly to do an advocacy training here at the convention, and that's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about some simple steps that each of us can and need to take to be better advocates here in the state of California. I think I've sort of mentioned this before, that I have a dream of building a statewide army of advocates all over the state, because I want to give you a little thought that came to me last night, and I mentioned this in my presentation, but for those of you that might have missed that last night when I was doing my legislative report. We heard during the general session yesterday about the closure of the Oregon School for the Blind. Some leader in the legislature got it in her head that closing the School for the Blind was somehow supposed to be a good thing, and enough people went along with her that they went and closed that thing. I submit that if every one of those Oregon legislature members had been personally acquainted with a graduate of the Oregon School for the Blind, they wouldn't have even thought of closing it. Now, let me ask you this. Think of who the person is that's your assembly member. Do they know a graduate of the California School for the Blind? Think about that. That's good. We need 119 more. All right. So this is going to be an interactive discussion. I have a list of items that we want to cover, but what I'm more concerned about is that we have an interactive discussion, not that I cover everything on my list, because I'm going to come back and do the rest later if we need to. So, first of all, what's going to happen is I'm going to give you information. So know that whenever I'm on the program, whenever you get the program, you're looking at the program, you're seeing what you're going to do, and you see my name, you know you're going to need to take notes. And second, you know you're going to get a homework assignment. So I'm going to actually give several homework assignments here. So I need somebody to keep me honest and count the homework assignments for me. Is Ed Crespin still in the room?
Yeah.
Ed, I want you to keep a count so you can tell us at the end how many homework assignments I dumped on everybody this afternoon. Okay? Are you with me?
Well.
All right. Okay. Now, mostly what we're going to be doing here is going to be discussion. I'm going to make some comments, and then we'll have questions and answers, and we'll go back and forth. And rather than killing Ed with the microphone, just if you want to have a question, just say, "Hey, Frank," and let's practice. Everybody say, "Hey, Frank." Good. So if you have a question, just say, "Hey, Frank," and I'll recognize you, and you give us your name, and then give your question. I'll repeat the question for the recording, and then we'll answer the question and move on. Okay. The first thing you want to do as an advocate is to get organized. So part of getting organized is being able to get in touch with me. So I'm going to give you my contact info. And if you don't get it all written down, I often put it in the California Connection. I put it on my reports. All of my articles in the Blind California will have my contact information. But here it is. It's Frank Welty. The way I spell my last name is W, E like echo, L like lady, T like telephone, E like echo. My email address is frank.welty, W-E-L-T-E, at ccbnet.org. Phone number, I'm going to give you the office. You can call the office phone number, the 800-221-8255. 6359. I'm usually in there a couple days a week, so you can leave messages and I can pick up messages. But if it's something that's kind of urgent and you don't want to wait maybe for a few days for me to pick up the phone messages, it's okay within reason to call my cell phone. 10 o'clock p.m. would probably not be real welcome, but, you know, within reason, though. And that, oh, hey, who's calling for the phone? Hey, Lisa, what's your question? Email's probably best because, you know, it's more flexible. But, you know, if it's something really urgent, like has to be done today, it might be a phone. But otherwise, email's probably best. But anyway, the phone, my cell number is 650-576-4177. Now you know how to contact me. I'm going to want to know how to contact you.
Hi.
Now, the first thing I need is to have somebody to contact. That means my first homework assignment is for every chapter president this week, within a week, to give me the name and contact information for your legislative chair in your chapters. A lot of you have done that. That's great. Might be nice to drop me a line or leave me a message just to confirm that it's still the same person. A number of you have done that, and I appreciate that. But I need a contact in every single chapter and special interest affiliate without exception. You think your chapter's not into advocacy? You better be. Because things are going to happen that aren't going to ignore you just because you're not political. When they cut SSI, they're not going to leave you alone because you're not political. Got it?
Yeah.
So you better get political because politics is going to come to you whether you like it or not. Okay, well, let me tell you what a legislative chair is going to do. First off, as a legislative chair, the second assignment, I should mention again, is giving, what you have is the legislative chair. The second assignment is to actually give me that person's contact info. The third assignment is for you, the legislative chair, to contact me if I haven't contacted you first within the next couple of weeks. Now, my contacts are not just going to be limited to your chapter legislative chair. You know, maybe your chapter already has a great legislative chair who's doing a great job, but you want to be an advocate too. There's plenty of room for that. So if you want to be an advocate, I've actually created an email distribution list where I send out information. I have one for the legislative chairs, and I've started another one for what I call CCB advocates, which is people who aren't already legislative chairs, but they want to be plugged in, they want to be involved. If you want to be one of our CCB advocates, then contact me and I'll put you on the list so you'll be informed. You'll get those legislative updates automatically. You'll get other information. And as much as I can, when there's stuff that's specific to your area, I will notify you as much as I can so that to help share that information. So do get in touch with me if you'd like to be one of our CCB advocates. So once we're all connected, the next step is for us all to get informed. So the next task is read the California Connection weekly. Because, of course, not only that's where I'm going to let you know when I've done a legislative update, and also some of my information will be there as well, right in the connection. But, of course, there's a whole lot of other important CCB connection that just isn't governmental affairs stuff that's important for you to know. I want to stop for a moment. Do we have any more questions yet? Any Hey Franks out there? Not yet?
Hey, Frank.
Hey.
What about the people who have put some of your information on the connection? What about people who want to be advocates who do not have access to the web and email?
Let me know because the telephone still works. So by all means, if you're not a computer person but you want to be involved, and I know Kathy does because she already is involved, by all means, get in touch with me, leave me a phone message, and let me know that you want to be an advocate even though you're not maybe a computer person, and I will make sure to share that information with you. Also, when I do my legislative updates, along with sending them out an email and putting them up on our website, I will record that message on the CCB phone system so that along with checking the connection weekly, the next task that you'll want to do is to read the legislative updates when they're released. And that means for those of you that aren't computer people, it means calling in and listening to my updated legislative update. And those of you that have computers can get it by email or read it on the website. But yes, by all means, whatever your situation, whether you're techie or not, you can be an advocate and we want you to be involved. And I want to share with you another great source of information that's starting to come around. It's not everywhere yet, but some of your counties, and hopefully more as time goes by, have set up an information phone number. You know, over the years, they've had the problem that people who, you know that when you call 911, it's only supposed to be basically for life-threatening emergencies, right? Yeah. But they have the problem with people calling 911 for every darn thing, right? So they've set up a similar phone number for general information, and that's 211. So the next assignment I'm going to give you is on Monday, pick up the phone, dial 211, and see what happens. And, yes, go ahead. That's too bad. Yes, and that would be good to know because it's going to... Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't repeat. Christy was saying that that she called her 211 number in San Bernardino County because she wanted to report a situation, and she found out that it was gone, that they didn't have their number running. And that's important to know so that if you find that out, let us know because maybe we can all work together to try and get those services restored where they've been cut because that is important. I want to give you another information number. Yes. Who's that? Hey, Melissa. You know, somebody's telling me that you were asking if the 211 number is landline or cell phone. I'm hearing people say both, so I think that's correct.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so yes, you can do both. Hey. Yes. You want to which phone number? My phone number? Oh, our 800 number. The CCB 800 number is 800-221-6359. We've got a chorus going here. Woo! Very good. 6359. Anyway, where was I? Yes. Good idea. Judy was pointing out that for those of you that have the unlimited long distance and you want to save CCB a few dollars, of course, you can call in on our local Sacramento number. And that local number goes to the same office is 916-441-2100. So either one of those numbers will go to the office. And I want to give you one really great information number. It's not like a political or necessarily an advocacy information number, but it's just great when you want to research, get answers to questions that you have relating to vision loss. It's the Vision Loss Resource Center at the Lighthouse. And Beth, I don't know why you didn't give out this number, but it is, and I'm getting it here, 888-400-8933. And that's great. You know, if you have a question, you want to know, where to find a resource or how to find, if your county doesn't have 211, but you still need to find out what services are available in your county, can you get some help finding that information? they're just a great resource for tracking down information for you, and you can call from anywhere. So, you know, it doesn't have just have to be in the San Francisco area to get help. So all of you, if you need help with finding blindness information, that's a great resource. The next thing, and we're still in the area of getting informed, is you need to get the contact information for the people who represent you in government, local, state, county, federal, all of it. Now, I'm going to have you do it by clapping your hands. First off, how many people are still in the room? Clap your hands. Okay, good, 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 good. Now, how many of you know who represents you in the state assembly? Better than I hoped. Okay, good. How about in the state senate? Good, good, good. How about in the House of Representatives in Congress? Dear guys, you guys are doing, I've got the tough people here. You guys are on top of it. Now I'm going to be mean. Who's your mayor? How about your mayor? You know your mayor? I have to admit, I haven't been in San Leandro that long, so I'm not sure I know who the mayor is yet. So I have some homework to do, too.
Homework for Frank.
So, you see, and why is this important? Because, you know, with term limits, especially in the state legislature, the person who's your assembly person this year, even if they were just elected, you know, if your assembly member was elected in 2008, then by the end of 2014, they're going to be gone from the assembly. And the odds are that on average, a third of you are going to be losing your member of the state assembly this year, right? You know, some of them may move to state senate, some of them may do other things. So somebody's going to take their place. It's important for you to know those somebodies, because as I've said before, the city councilman that you get acquainted with this year may be the assembly member next year. And in 5 years, they may be the state senator or the congressperson. So it's not too early. You may think, well, they're just city council. Who are they? Well, they may not be city council in 2 years. And if they already know you, it's easier to get to know them when they're on the city council than when they're in Washington, right? Do we have any more questions before I go on?
I have a comment, right?
Yes, Kathy.
If anybody reads the articles I write in D.C., I reread my article and I shocked myself. We were talking about term limits, and it looked in there, like I said, term limits were, what I said was they're important for groups like the council because we all know each other. But it looked like I thought it was okay for term limits for California, and I said they have not been good in California, have not been bad in California. Term limits are terrible for us in California. So
to repeat that, what Kathy said, term limits are tough here in California, and if our representatives are going to be educated, they need us to educate them about our issues, because they're not going to find that out for themselves. Very important. And I just wanted to, by clapping your hands, is there anybody here who really isn't sure about who represents you in Congress or in the state legislature? You know, hey, it's especially if you've moved you only see their names once every 2 years when you're voting, right? And it's hard to remember if you don't have a relationship with them who that person is. So that's fine, you know. And some great ways to be able to find that information, call information and ask for the county registrar of voters in your county, and call them and ask them which legislative districts you are in, you know, and they'll, you know, just to give them your address and they can pull up which districts you're in. And then based on that, you can find out who the representative is in your your district. Now, if you have the web, it's a lot easier to do because you can go to the website for the state legislature or the House of Representatives and find a link where it, and it varies, but it's usually pretty obvious. It's like, it'll be like find your legislator, or there's one website, it's called, in California, it's called LegInfo. It's www.leginfo.ca.gov. It's www.l as in Lima, E, G as in girl, I-N-F-O dot C-A for California and dot gov. And one of the things it has on there is it has a link to, it's, the link is, it says your legislature. And when you follow that link, it brings you to a form where you type in your zip code, and then it comes back with the person that represents you for your zip code. Very handy. And there's a similar thing on the U.S. House of Representatives website. But again, if you're not a computer person, just call your registrar of voters and ask them who the person is. I want to mention that one thing that I'm working on is doing a series of articles in the Blind Californian called Advocacy 101. And the next article, the next Advocacy 101 article is just going to be contact information for government. And from time to time, I'm going to do that so that you can add to your address book of advocacy contacts. So I'm going to share that in the Blind Californian from time to time. Hey, Dan.
I have a great hotline.
Yes, Dan.
It's called the California State Operator.
The California State Operator is?
And it's the phone number. I don't know if there's an 800 number, but the state number is
9900.
And the website is
website
www.cold.ca.gov.
This is
let me explain this hotline because it's really interesting. This is the state information line. It will give you state employees. It will give you supervisors. It will give you any state employee in the state of California. It will give you any legislators. Any committees. That was my best used resource for the last 10 years. I just gave it away.
Wow, I didn't know that. Thanks, Dan. That's good.
Don't forget about library references.
That's what Roger was saying, library reference librarians. Yes, you can call your public library, ask for the reference desk. That's why they're there. They like finding stuff. So ask that you can ask them for that kind of information.
I don't know if they all like it.
Well, Don is over here saying, I don't know if they all like it. Some are better than others. But it's another resource. So you've got, right here, we've got three great ways to get information, that contact information for your legislators. I'm getting close to the end of my time, so that's going to be as far as we get. But we're going to continue this. Yes?
What's the number for the legislative hotline again?
The legislative hotline again is 916-322-9900. And just before I let go of the microphone, has this been helpful?
Yes.
Good. Now, what would you like to see some things cover the next time we do this? Because I will plan to have another one of these sessions somewhere on the program, whether it's in general session or as a breakout session in the fall. So what are some things you'd like to see us cover as far as advocacy training for this fall? How to write to them.
Madam Chair, next spring, when I am no longer have to deal with putting this convention together, Frank and I will, I think, be able to really do a joint I know how well he can do, and I have got a lot of experience in some of this stuff. I think that Frank and I can really put on a good, you know, advocacy workshop with a couple different types of segments, because there's things he can do that I really can't do, and there may be some things I can do that will complement that. So I'm offering
Excellent.
To help out with that next spring.
Hey, try and get Jeff and whoever might become president.
Kathy.
I would hope that we all, who are evidently interested in legislation, will insist that this is one of the most important things we do.
Hey.
Absolutely.
Amen.
Yes.
For the record, Kathy's saying that whoever's the next president, they need to insist that this advocacy is one of the most important things we do, and I concur. Thank you.
Program for it.
Yes.
What I would like to see is a list of committee and committee chairmen who have serving responsibilities for a bunch of 10 legislative
It's unlegitimate.
Yeah, but
Dirk was saying he'd like to see a list of the relevant committees and committee chairpersons in the legislature who deal with our issues. And Dirk, that's a great idea. I'm going to make a note to myself to work on that. And there's a hey Frank in the back. Who's the yes? That was who? Oh yes, capital H, silly me. For those of you who weren't here last night, on May 18th, we're going to do Capital Day in Sacramento. I'm going to need you to do, if you want to be in Capital Day, first, you need to let me know so that we'll know who's coming so that we can be ready with preparing lunch for people. And if anybody needs assistance finding a place to camp out the night before, that's Tuesday, May 18th. Call me or write to me at the CCB office and let me know that you're interested in coming. Because one thing I need you to do, the second thing that you'll need to do, is to make an appointment with your legislators. And I'm going to need to keep track of that so that we can cover as many offices as possible. So again, if you're planning to be part of Capital Day this year, May 18th, let me know right away so we can start making plans and so that I can help you get ready and get the information you need and all of that. We had somebody from Redwood Empire with a question. Go ahead. A workshop on how to write an initiative. Okay. I'm making it. Oh, she said she'd like to see a workshop on how to write an initiative because she'd like to see an initiative to make congressmen be on Medicare. I don't think that the state initiative would do that, but that's...
No, you can't get the federal government to have initiatives because don't have that. But we can do, though, a workshop on initiatives. I've written many. I've had to edit many horrible initiatives. So if there is some outcry for a workshop on initiatives, I can reluctantly do one.
Yes.
Margaret.
Hi, Margaret.
Something that gives us some resources on how to be better advocates in our own community. I just got an email the other day to go to some meeting that's going on the disaster plan for the county, and I really don't know anything about that. Things like access, I'm getting asked because I brought it up at a planning committee the plans are getting approved and, you know, crooked sidewalks, and now I'm getting architectural plans to look at. I don't have any idea, so it's kind of a resource list.
That's an excellent suggestion, and by the way, on a relevant note to that, I want to mention that for those of you who didn't make it to the Committee on Access and Transportation and Council of Citizens with Low Vision program yesterday, they did one of the best programs on advocacy that I've ever heard, and if you can, when the tapes become available, if you didn't catch it live here yesterday, or if for those of you with the internet, if you can't get it over ACB Radio World or on the website. But when those recordings become available, whether on our website or on cassettes from our office, I would encourage you to listen to that, because they did some great feedback on how to advocate with companies for more accessible products and services, and it was just excellent. So if you missed it yesterday, don't miss it when it's available on tape.
Hey, Frank.
Yes.
Preston.
Yes, Preston.
One of the best resources in terms of like disasters and that sort of thing is the local Red Cross.
Preston is saying that the Red Cross is a great resource for information on disaster issues. That's a good point. Thank you, Preston.
Hey, Frank.
Yes, Donna.
I also wanted to say that anyone who's getting things on disaster preparedness and stuff like that, touch base with me. We've been doing some things in L.A. County, and I've been working on some stuff with the state for a while. So touch base. And if you want to know how to find me, the cell is 626-233-2991. And if you do the email, I'll give you the easier one, which gets right into my personal one. You've got Donna, D-O-N-N-A, dot Pomerantz, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-T-Z, like zebra, at ccbnet.org. So, touch base.
And I'm guessing that this is going to be the last one, because I think I've just about run out of time here. Go ahead. Yes, Pam.
San Diego Valley Chapter.
Yay, Pam.
I was just going to say that I find, and maybe some other people find too, that we get intimidated by the word advocacy.
Yeah.
What we've done in our chapter is we form an advocacy committee, and what we do is we get together from time to time, either at a restaurant or we've gotten together at Donald's, and we have dinner or something and brought up something to drink too and stuff. We kind of get people to come to it.
Afterward.
Well, that's not necessarily true.
Anyway. Drunk enough, you're good advocates.
To grow to those, and then they really do find that they can become involved and that they are valuable to us. So I just wanted to put that out there.
So what you're saying is make advocacy more fun by organizing an advocacy committee in your chapter and then getting the committee together in a social situation like at a restaurant and something or doing something like that, so that it's not just dry but it's fun as you're doing your advocacy activities.
And then think about it and drink about it.
Think about it and drink about it.
And that is a great idea to end on. So, by the way, Ed, how many homework assignments did I give them?
One for the president and six for individuals.
All right. Thanks, Ed.
All right. Thank you, Frank.
What did I do?
And right after right after we get out of here, we will be having the Governmental Affairs Committee, and we will be getting back to bill numbers.
Yes, thank you, Frank. Okay, next on our agenda is Bits of San Mateo County History, and our presenter is Joan, and I don't know if you pronounce it Levy or Levy.
Either,
okay, or either. Board of Directors, San Mateo County History Museum, Redwood City, California.
Yay!
All right. And Joan is on the Board of Directors at the San Mateo County History Museum, and she belongs to several other local historical societies. She is a third-generation Californian. Her mother was born in San Francisco 3 months before the fire of 1906. And her grandmother was born in a mining town in Calaveras County. Thus, She has always had an interest in California history. Joan completed her college education late in life with a BA in history from San Francisco State University, class of 94. She wrote a history column in a local paper for 5 years and has written a few articles for various historical society journals. Please welcome Joan Levy.
Okay, I'm not used to such high-tech stuff like microphones. Well, she told you more about my life history than most people know, but admittedly, I am a history junkie. I always want to know, you know, the how comes and the whys when I travel around. So I was asked to come today and speak to you briefly on the history of San Mateo County and tell you some of our stories of this area. Now, San Mateo County is a place of diversity in many ways. Now, geographically, it's a peninsula or a strip of land bound on the east by San Francisco Bay and on the west by the Pacific Ocean. To the north, we're capped by the city of San Francisco, and to the south, natural boundaries separate us from other counties. Now, right down the center of our land, running north and south, is a ridge of mountains that provides a barrier to the winds and fog of the ocean, creating microclimates that make most of the bayside comfortably warm and sunny. And this ridge also makes travel between the two sides somewhat inconvenient and contributes to a degree of isolation to the communities on the seacoast. In the mountains to the south, there are large stands of redwood trees that eventually attracted loggers to this area. And Redwood City, as you can guess from the name, was the access point from which the lumber was shipped. Now, ever since the Spanish came to this area and sort of enveloped the Native Americans that were living here, San Mateo County has been a supply source for San Francisco. The Mission and Presidio, or the fort that were built in San Francisco, they were put at the top of the peninsula for strategic purposes to guard the entrance to San Francisco Bay. But unfortunately, the weather up there is not well suited to agriculture, so farming outposts were built in San Mateo County to provide food for the soldiers, priests, and mission Indians. Oops. And the farm labor, of course, was done by the Indians, too. Mexico declared its independence from Spain, and California became a subsidiary of the new government. The mission system was disbanded, and the lands were granted to as ranchos to upper echelon Californios. There were 17 ranchos here in San Mateo County. Most of the coastal lands on both of the ocean and the bay sides were taken up by them. Foreign trade was now legal, and the rancheros prospered in the hide and tallow business, raising cattle. Foreigners moved into the area to trade, and a little village of Yerba Buena was established at the cove where the ships would come in. Ranchers traded with the visiting ships from around the world, and any attempt at self-sufficiency was forgotten. The United States and Mexico then went to war in 1846. It began as a disagreement in Texas, but an American port on the Pacific was one of the objectives of the United States government, so California was vital. The locals here had little allegiance to Mexico, since Mexico had always ignored them, and so there was very little military activity here during that war. In 1848, the United States won, signed the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, and gold had been discovered on Sutter's property, but nobody knew about that yet. So California now belonged to the United States, and the gold rush began. And the Spanish-Mexican California was overrun by people, mostly men, from all over the world, but especially from the United States. Now, the initial effect on our county here was that the non-landed Hispanic Californios grouped together on the coast, sort of in a means of protection. on a rancho that's now the town of Half Moon Bay. Now, the people that lived there called the town San Benito. Everybody else called the town Spanish Town because that's basically what it was to them. It was really the first town that we had in San Mateo County. Now, the gold rush caused a huge growth in California's population. And Yerba Buena changed its name to the more recognizable San Francisco, and California became a state. Now, the condition of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo promised that the Mexican landholders could hold their grants, but each one had to be reviewed by the federal government and certified. So no one in our county lost their land to this process, but the legal fees to the lawyers that handled it were usually paid in land, as the rancheros didn't have any money or cash. And the time that was required to settle these things went on for years. So it was frequently the children or grandchildren that were settling these, which was an exponentially larger number of people. So the old Mexican land grants were, in fact, broken up as they were sold by cash-strapped Californios or acquired in lieu of cash by the lawyers or other creditors. Now, when California became a state back in 1850, this peninsula was part of San Francisco County, and there was quite a bit of corruption back then. The people of San Francisco tried to clean up their government, but the bad guys kept moving back and forth between the city government and the county government jobs. And finally, the people figured if they had just one government, they could control all this corruption. So they decided to cut off the county at the city limits and let the rest of the county be somebody else's problem. Now, the crooks saw this as an advantage because they could now have their very own county. All the gambling and other illegal activities could take place just across the county line. So San Mateo County was formed in 1856 as an inadvertent payoff to the criminal element of San Francisco.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, there wasn't too much down here back then. It was a sparsely populated agricultural area with about 2,500 people. And the former governor of the state, John McDougall, had a home and extensive property down here in Belmont. Now, McDougall had been governor for a year, but he wasn't exactly a stellar character. He was elected lieutenant governor in California's first election, and he became governor when the first governor resigned. And the most notable act that he did during his tenure was to declare war against the American Indians, claiming that they were in an armed uprising. So McDougall has been described as a quick-tempered inebriate, a gentlemanly drunkard, a fine-looking gentleman with a cultivated mind and brilliant social talents. So I guess it depended on how sober he was when you met him. He also engaged once in an inconclusive duel near his home in Belmont. At any rate, John McDougall was squarely on the side of the crooks in my little story. The first election to name the various county officials was to be held May 12, 1856, and another matter was the location of the county seat. Now, this would be prosperity to the little town and eventually building government buildings on someone's property. So the obvious cities in the running included Redwood City, which was a growing lumber port, San Mateo, which was a major crossroads between the peninsula and the road to the coast, and it was centrally located in the county, or tiny Belmont, home of John McDougall. Now, the thugs planned to control county government by taking over certain jobs, like the sheriff, the district attorney, and majority members of the Board of Supervisors, and they also wanted to give the county seat to McDougall. They felt that stuffing the ballot boxes of only three voting precincts would be enough to accomplish this. Now, one was the polling place at the Abbey House Saloon, which was run by one of their cronies in the Colma district. Another was the rural Crystal Springs Station. And the third was conveniently located in the home of John McDougall in Belmont. Now, our criminal element was experienced in fixing elections. Some of them had trained in New York at Tammany Hall, and they all had experience from San Francisco. The ballot boxes with false bottoms were not new to them. They had passenger lists from newly arrived ships to provide voter names, and they were familiar with strong-arm technique. So on election day, the locals found these three polling places run by armed men that they'd never seen before. After the polls closed, the ballot counting, if there actually was any, was done in relative secrecy. And in a miracle of voter turnout, the ballots cast in three voting places were larger than citizens living there. In Colma, 500 of the 50 voters cast their ballots. At Crystal Springs, the 25 adult men managed to cast 297 votes. An additional 500 votes were cast at Belmont. Now, remember, the population of the whole county was about 2,500 men, women, and children. And in those days, only the men voted. Not surprisingly, the crooks had won their election, and Belmont was the new county seat. Now, that was no doubt the best voter turnout our county has ever seen. Now, two things saved San Mateo County from absolute corruption from its very beginning. First, the crooks had the incredible bad luck of having one of their own kill a popular newspaper editor in San Francisco 2 days after the election. Now, that was the straw that broke the camel's back in San Francisco, so their vigilante committee rose up and began running crooks out of town and hanging a few. So San Mateo County's newly elected representatives were nowhere to be found. Even McDougal decided that he was due a brief and well-deserved vacation. Now, the second factor in our salvation was that for some reason, the crooks had failed to secure the office of judge in the county. And an honest man, Benjamin Fox, was elected to that office. Now, a lawsuit was filed by some of the losers of the election, and it was presided over by Judge Fox. So the first trial in the county was over the fraudulent election held in the hotel in Belmont on June 10th. The irregularities of the election were testified to, and the results of the three suspect voting places nullified. This resulted in the county seat being moved to Redwood City, where it still is, and the properly elected men put into office. So San Mateo County got off to a clean start after all. Now, as I mentioned before, this was an agricultural area populated by 2,500 souls. But there were trees and streams here. The weather was warmer than in the city and less foggy, at least on the bayside. And the wealthy people in San Francisco began to build country homes for summer living. And they grew fruit and vegetables, produced eggs and other things to supply their San Francisco homes as well as for their use here. And actually, they had employees that lived on the property that did the actual work. A railroad line was built between San Francisco and San Jose to facilitate travel along the peninsula, but the cost of that travel was prohibitive except for the elite. Country living included other pastimes to be enjoyed by the fortunate, like hunting, fishing, riding, racing, and other sports that they could practice on their estates. And they had staffs of gardeners to maintain the elegant gardens and grounds. By the 1890s, the population was almost 10,000. Now, in 1883, just before that date that I mentioned, Colma was a small place consisting of two stores, a blacksmith, and a saloon. It was described as having some manufacturing, but the manufacturing turned out to be just a tannery. The history of the town is vague. It was a wide area in the road of farmlands. It was a crossroads, like the beginning of a lot of towns. When you came there from San Francisco, you reached the intersection of El Camino Real and the San Pedro Road, so it was necessary to decide if you were going to go west to the coast side or east to the bayside at that point. And as was customary, there was a watering trough, a store, and a saloon to mark this place of decision. Now, around 1856, a schoolhouse had been built there and gave some substance to the place, and Schoolhouse Station became the railroad stop in the 1860s. Now, in 1871, the railroad changed the name to Colma, and nobody knows why. A post office appeared there, and in the 1870s, some of the land got subdivided. Now, the business thrived just this side of the county line. The businesses engaged mainly in things that were prohibited in the city. So they had boxing matches and dog races and all of the peripheral activity that you can think of just across the county line. Yes, San Mateo County was still supplying San Francisco's needs. Meanwhile, a group of cemeteries developed in a nearby area that was referred to at the time as Lawndale. The ground was sort of sandy. And Holy Cross Cemetery was established in 1887 when the Catholic Church opted to buy land that was cheaper in San Mateo County. It was followed by two Jewish cemeteries and then Cypress Lawn in 1892. By 1904, there were 10 cemeteries in the area. It was an ideal location, accessible from San Francisco by auto and by train, and I guess that sandy soil was a little easier to dig in, too. Now, at this time, San Francisco began to feel crowded as it grew, and it didn't want to waste any more of its land on cemeteries. So in 1898, burials were prohibited in the city cemetery. 1901, the Board of Supervisors prohibited burials anywhere in San Francisco. And in 1912, they voted to evict all of the existing cemeteries from the city. Now, today in San Francisco, there are cemeteries only in the Presidio, which, of course, was federal land, at historic Mission Dolores, and perhaps one or two single burial sites somewhere in the city. The cemetery owners down here began to worry that some laws like San Francisco could be passed here, too, so they decided to lay out a town. Now, they had to have 500 people to form a municipality, so they arranged for that and formally incorporated into a town governed by people, but in fact controlled by what was by now 13 cemeteries. Now, they intended to name the town Memorial Park, but there was already a place in the county called Memorial Park. Then they decided to try Lawndale, and they found in Southern California there was already a Lawndale.
Yeah.
So finally, they officially named the town Colma. After all, it was the Colma post office that was delivering their mail. So now there is a town called Colma that was created as a city for the dead. The community shows no ambition to grow in its living population. Colma has one saloon, historic old Malloy's, and they have other businesses that are cemetery-related, florists and monument builders. And they have shopping centers that swell the daytime population to about 70,000, which provides a tax base that makes Coleman's 1,000 or so residents the envy of the peninsula. Okay, now, who was Burlingame, and why was this town named for him? Now, the short answer is Anson Burlingame, but the more puzzling answer is why? Burlingame never lived in Burlingame. Burlingame never lived in California. And there was no evidence that he ever planned to live here. Anson Burlingame was born in New York State, later elected to the Massachusetts Senate, and then on to the U.S. Congress, and he was appointed ambassador to China. Now, Burlingame stopped once in 1866 while he was traveling between China and the U.S. in San Francisco. And a local millionaire by the name of William Ralston entertained him in his typically lavish dinner at his estate down here in Belmont. Now, according to reports, Ralston had about 100 guests all seated facing in one direction, and then the wall rose up before them, revealing his dining room, set for dinner with costumed Chinese servants. The table was laid with the finest of linen, silver, crystal, and porcelain. According to the story, Ralston asked Burlingame to pick out a site for a town to be named in his honor. And Burlingame himself bought 1,200 acres of the Rancho San Mateo. Now, perhaps this was out of gratitude to Ralston or as a result of some sort of overindulgence. No one really knows. But Burlingame died a few years later, and Ralston very thoughtfully bought back the property from his widow. Now, Ralston intended to develop the property by subdividing it, but he died before he did so. And his successor, William Sharon, surveyed a town, but he could never find any buyers. So the land continued to be referred to as that Burlingame property. So the name did have some legitimate, if fleeting, significance. Instead of a town, in 1893, wealthy San Franciscans organized a country club on this property, and the founders named it the Burlingame Country Club. Originally, they built 6 cottages as summer homes for some of the members. Now, when they say cottages, it's not a cottage like you or I might think. These were really very lavish homes. And over the years, members built more expensive homes and cottages. The club pressed the Southern Pacific for a train station, which they ultimately got, which is not a surprise because the club was made up of very well-connected citizens. And a small village grew up by the station with some businesses to serve the membership. Now, things changed very quickly after April of 1906. After that earthquake and fire of San Francisco, a flood of refugees poured south into our peninsula. A real town developed around this train station. And then the country club crowd, worried that their community was becoming a little too bourgeois, incorporated their territory as the town of Hillsboro in 1910. Now, in 1906, as I mentioned, the earthquake and fire devastated San Francisco. Most of the big San Francisco mansions were ruined, and much of the middle-class housing in the city burned. Many people fled to surrounding rural areas. The rich, of course, could retire to their country homes, which were less likely to have been badly damaged. One earthquake story of note is that of A.P. Giannini. He lived in San Mateo, but he owned the fledgling Bank of Italy in San Francisco. When the conflagration occurred, A.P. realized that his bank was in the path of the fire, and he and his employees were able to salvage $80,000 in gold and the bank records from the vault. They hid these things in the bottom of a wagon and took them to his brother-in-law's place, and then under cover of darkness brought the valuables down to his home in San Mateo. I understand that he hid them in the fireplace under the ashes. At any rate, 7 days after the earthquake, A.P. Giannini was able to set up a sign, banking as usual, and begin operating out of his brother's home in San Francisco. He even set up a plank across barrels to be closer to his customers. Now, Giannini's the one who introduced the idea of branch banking to the world of finance. In 1909, he opened his first out-of-town branch in San Jose. In 1930, he changed the name to the Bank of America. So by 1945, it had become the largest banking institution of the world. Now, after the fire, refugees traveled by whatever means they could. Some walked out the Mission Road to the top of the hill where John Daly had a dairy. The locals opened their homes to the dispossessed and provided them with food, and Daly provided milk to everyone and let the people camp in his fields. Now, before winter, the Red Cross built emergency shelters in San Francisco's parks. They rented them to the refugees for $4 or $6 a month, depending on the size. The shacks were 14 by 18 feet and divided into 2 or 3 rooms, but they could be used for only 1 year. The occupants then had the opportunity to buy them at a nominal cost, but they'd have to relocate them to get them out of the parks. So Daly subdivided his farm into lots. His hillside was within easy hauling distance to the city. Moving these earthquake houses became a specialized business at $25 per house. Daly sold his lots for $400, $10 down, $10 a month. From the beginning, this area was home for working class people of modest means, and that was the beginning of what would become Daly City. Now, all along the peninsula, new towns sprang up and small existing villages grew. A streetcar line finally ran down the peninsula to San Mateo, providing transportation affordable to the middle class. They could now enjoy the benefits of country living and commute to jobs in the city. San Mateo County became the first commuter suburb of the West. In July of 1921, a meeting was held to plan improvements to a small beach that had been in use since the 1880s at Coyote Point. The idea for an amusement park came up, and plans were made to add a good road to the beach and a parking lot to an enclosed pool and restaurant. Investors planned more elaborate facility to rival New York's Coney Island. They purchased the Coyote Point land, and construction began in January of 1922 with an estimated opening date of May. In February, there was a change of ownership, and the syndicate incorporated under the name Pacific City. The opening was slipped to June, and a dedication was held in March. Plans included a 4-acre children's playground, a merry-go-round. They were putting in a pier that was to be 500 feet by 30 feet, fences, playground equipment, lighting, bathing suit rentals, a scenic railroad, Ferris wheels, cigar stands, hot dog stands, lunch counter, ice cream, soda, popcorn stands, you name it, they had it, or planned it at least. No further mention was made about that indoor swimming pool. In addition, for transportation, you had trains, streetcars, bus lines, a highway, and they were going to add excursion boats and launches to come to that pier. Well, the formal opening took place on July 1st. On July 4th, 100,000 people came through the gates. Local celebrities took part in the parades, and the dance pavilion faced the boardwalk with the back overlooking a Japanese tea garden. November 12th, the park closed for the winter after an estimated 1 million people visited it. The following year, they added a roller coaster called the Comet. This was second largest in the U.S. and the fastest in the West with a straight drop of 80 feet. Another change of ownership took place. Pacific City closed forever in late 1923 after operating only 2 seasons. Now, what happened to Pacific City? Well, one thing was the wind. Although the mornings at the beach were very nice, every afternoon in the summer, an unpleasantly strong wind came up. Also in the second season, the beach became contaminated due to sewage disposal. Now, without swimming, there was little to attract people to the site. The glorious ballroom became a roller skating rink, and the rest of the buildings deteriorated until 1933 when it was all demolished because it had become a target for vandals. Okay, I've touched on only a few of our stories of local history in the time I had here. I hope you've enjoyed your stay, and I hope you come back and visit us again.
Thank you very, very much. That was very interesting. Thank you. All righty. I want to thank everybody for coming to this session. Take care. Bye.